I'd like to thank the Theosophical Society for having me here today. As you know, I'm here to speak about death and dying, but I'm also going to speak about how we can live our lives better with death as our teacher. It's been an honor and a pleasure for me to have spent so many years cultivating a sense of comfort in regard to death and dying by working in hospice. So my wish today, more than anything else, is that this foundation of joy that I've received will help each and every one of you to reach a place of comfort within yourselves on this topic, because it's a hard one sometimes, isn't it? So we'll start the presentation. We have some goals for today about our discussion, and one of them is, what is hospice? What it does and what it doesn't do. There are some misunderstandings about that sometimes. What can I expect of the dying? We'll touch a little bit on the physical process, a little bit more on the spiritual process. And what can I do to be positively involved in the dying process for those that I love, those that I encounter, and for myself when the time comes? So my path to hospice growing up, I really had no exposure to death. I was in my mid-30s before I lost most of my grandparents. That was a blessing. But we had no young death, unexpected death, or violent death in our family at all, so I really had nothing in my personal experience to bring to the table for hospice. Nursing school, you would probably be surprised as I was to know, was they really didn't teach anything about death and dying, which is a surprise because on every end of the spectrum, in all the areas of nursing care, nurses are going to run into death and dying somewhere along their path. But it really isn't taught. We're educated to sustain life. Fixing, curing, saving, treating. And those are the things that we learn, but almost nothing on death and dying. I see other nurses here, and I see them shaking their heads going, yeah, you're right. About 5 years after I started nursing, I was doing long-term care nursing, I just felt a divine nudging that nursing was my calling, but that I needed to do something a little bit different. And so when I got to the T in the road, I turned right toward hospice, which was where I felt I was being led. So my hospice training, the clinical management of nursing interventions, medication dosing, symptom management, and comfort care was very well taught. We were very well trained in all those things. But I started to notice that there really wasn't any practical training in how to talk with the dying, how to talk with families, and how to address the matter at hand, which was that this family was going to lose a loved one, and this loved one was going to lose their life. They didn't teach you that. So I started to figure out that that isn't something that can really be taught. The knowledge would need to come from my own personal comfort level with death and dying, and examining my own understanding and feelings about death. Because without self-reflection, how could I help someone else through their dying, through the dying of a loved one, and truly understand what their needs were going to be at those times? Peaceful Passages began as a journal that I wrote for myself. It served as a process, a way to process all of the loss and the grief that I was experiencing as I journeyed with these patients, one after another, after another. It holds the name and the date of passing of every patient that I've ever cared for in my 18 years of hospice, and I think at last count that was about 1,800 patients that I've helped through their dying. It's a very dear journal to me. So, a little bit about hospice. It's important to know that hospice is comfort care and not curative care. It also has nothing to do with physician-assisted suicide. Those are two entirely different cases. Hospice patients, when they come on hospice, have already had their treatments, therapies, interventions, tests, all the things that are meant to help them with their disease or to cure them. And by the time they come on to hospice, they've already been told or decided themselves that they no longer wish to continue with curative care. Some people feel that when a person decides they no longer want the care or the cure, that this is giving up. They've fought the battle. They've fought the disease. But giving in and giving up are two entirely different things. We're all going to have a line in the sand, as we do with other areas of our life. We have a line in the sand. This is enough. This is as far as I'll go. And often when patients are sick and have been through some very grueling treatments, they decide, I don't want that anymore. It's important to support that patient's decision. the worst thing that can happen is that they've decided they would rather coast toward their death, and somebody is saying, no, you know, I'm the cheerleader. You got to keep going. You got to keep trying. You got to keep fighting. It's not a predicament that you would want to put anybody in that you love. So the line in the sand really is about quality versus quantity. And sometimes quality, a real quality life, although it might be shorter, is better than quantity. So how long might somebody be in hospice? It might be hours, might be weeks, and it might be years. We may be admitting a patient to hospice while they're on their deathbed and they won't even make it till morning. Or we may have a patient who has a disease process that has sort of we call it a sawtooth pattern to their disease. They have ups and they have downs. But if you watch my hand, their ups never go quite as high up and their downs go lower. And it's a longer process. It's actually sometimes a harder process. But it may be that they're ill with their terminal disease for years instead of days or weeks. I started to realize that all of the disease processes were terminal and would lead to death, obviously, and that my relationship with any patient or family would never be long-term. It was highly unlikely that I would ever see anybody restored to health. It's just not the patients that hospice gets. Quickly, the relationship between the hospice team and the family and the patient becomes intimate because so much needs to be done in such a short period of time. All of the management, all of the psychosocial issues, everything has to be squeezed into sometimes a very short time to make it matter. So I realized that I was going to suffer the loss of every patient I had and every family member every single time. So I knew these things in my head, but in my heart, I don't think in the beginning I had a clue of the amount of grieving that it was going to take me from move to one patient's death to another. And it started to take a toll on me. But my journal, which records all these people's names and little stories about them, helped me to process my own grief, and it helped me to help others through their grief. So Gone to Heaven, which was the initial name of my journal, eventually became Peaceful Passages. So I feel that I'm sort of the conduit to share the stories my patients seem to be telling with their varied dying experiences, because no two are alike, just like no two people are alike, no two families are alike. The dynamics change, the illness is different, and the stories are very different. The stories in the book, and that we'll talk about today, have three threads: the practical aspects of hospice care, so you can learn something about what is it, what do I need to know if I'm going into this situation? The physical aspects of dying are much more covered in that than they will be in this talk today, because that's a whole nother book unto itself. And then also the hope and the joy in the process of dying. So I look out at this audience today and I see all of our differences. I see different genders, ages, races, probably religious affiliations and careers. But our commonalities are that we're all born, we're all gonna live, and no one escapes death. Everyone who came before us and everyone who will come after is gonna walk through that final door at the end. And there's the door, there's a beautiful door. We're all gonna need to do that. So death is mostly a solitary path, but we have this in common with all mankind, even though we do it by ourselves. It's in common with all mankind and with any living thing. Plants, animals, anything are going to have a death. There are a lot of similarities between death and birth. Both, of course, are human conditions. But to both processes, there's a stopping and a starting. Anybody that's been with somebody in labor knows that it doesn't just go whoosh and you're done. There's a stopping and a starting. There's an opening and a closing. And it's the same with the dying process. It can take minutes, hours. It can take weeks sometimes. There's also a labor, hard work that we must go through to accomplish the task of preparing our body to enter this world or preparing our body to leave the world. That's why hospice nurses are sometimes called midwives of the soul. Isn't that a beautiful image? So, recognizing the solitary path and human condition of death and dying, to me, there's a message of hope in that, just that it is that way. It reinforces what we believe and already know, that life eventually brings us to death. Even if you think of a forest and trees dying and decaying and new life coming from that, it brings us to new life. It's reflected all around us, this beautiful cycle, in seasons and in nature and in any process that has a beginning and has an end to that beginning. So it's no surprise that we're part of that cycle, considering the intricate order of the universe. We're finding out every single day just how orderly our universe is and how beautifully orchestrated things are, and we're part of that system. So the physical process, as far as hospice specialty, is mostly pain control and symptom management. That pretty much sums it up as far as our bodily needs during the dying process. Just as important, sometimes even more important, is facilitating the communication between the family and the hospice staff, between family members and each other, and between family and the patient. But what I witness is that if our emotional and our spiritual needs are met, our body follows. There's often not much need for comfort care as far as the body if we've taken care of some of those mind-body or mind-spirit things. We would like to think that every family, if they have a death or a trauma happening in the family, that they come together in a beautiful way. But that's not always the case, because this is an emotionally charged time for families, and both the family and the patient need a lot of encouragement. The patient needs encouragement just to be able to go through their process. The family meets you at the door sometimes with deer in the headlights eyes and wringing their hands. We don't know what to do. They need encouragement that they can be a part of this process and a help in this process. The patient needs acceptance, that people understand that they're getting ready to die and that those around them accept that. That can be done as simply as saying, no matter what happens, I'm going to be okay. Or it's a little bit more difficult, but it's the same thing to say, I'm going to miss you, Mom, so much when you're gone. There's an acceptance there and a permission that happens that really changes things. There's a closure. It's a promotion of a peaceful death process when these things happen. So when the dying person's condition is accepted and acknowledged by their loved ones, something important clicks into place. You can almost see it. It's palpable. The process is eased. There's no more of the keeping the brave face or trying to do what other people want. They've been told, it's okay. If you have to go, it's okay. The process is eased, permission is granted, received, and the spiritual and emotional needs are met, and you see the struggle end. And that's what we would like to see for everyone. So why? Why does this happen? The acceptance and acknowledgement, assists the patient toward being able to relax into the dying process. And it also minimizes the worries and the disappointment and feelings of loss that that family might be feeling even before the event happens. So a shift occurs that you can see, and it's almost like watching somebody go from drive to cruise control. And they start to think more about how well can I live rather than how long will I live. And this frees up their future. Can you see how that would happen? They would just be able to let go of all those burdens. So, hospice begins with a holistic approach. The nurse is in place for the medical needs and the collaboration of all of the team and all of the details. There's a chaplain assigned to every patient for spiritual needs. There's a nursing assistant who's assigned to provide personal care for someone who's too weak to do it themselves. And there's a social worker who does a little bit of everything, but her specialty is finding community services that might be able to come in and assist the family and offer psychosocial support during the dying. So how does all of this promote a peaceful dying process? Well, this is the gift that hospice patients have given to me, and it's changed my life. And I say that because perhaps they had to wait until their dying time to understand how to live another way. I learned it by proxy. I got to see this and understand it and hear it from them, and it's changed my life. So when hospice patients are unencumbered by the fear or worry that starts out with their disease and with family members maybe not understanding their situation, they're unencumbered by fear or worry. They choose to live happily. They choose to live peacefully. They choose their battles, or they let go of battles entirely. They don't sweat the small stuff, and they don't make mountains out of molehills. There's no time. Why bother, right? So hospice patients know. I have a little sign that's hanging on my refrigerator. My children will attest to this for years that says, worry doesn't empty tomorrow of its sorrow. It empties today of its strength. We won't have this full knowing until it's our own final decline, except for me, because I got to learn it now. But we can begin to change that. We'll go into some of that. So here we've got our pessimist, Charlie Brown, and our philosopher, Snoopy. And Charlie Brown says with a big sigh, one day we're all going to die. And Snoopy says, but on every other day, we're not. So that's a way to look at our life as if there is one day that this is going to happen, but every day between now and then is going to be something beautiful and something special. So hospice patients, when they get to this point, begin to surround themselves with what feeds them, whether that's nature, art, music, literature, friends, family, favorite places. Their choices are based on a limited time frame, and they have a whole different focus about things. You might notice that their behaviors adjust toward living in a way that allows them in the end to say, it was a good life, all is well with my soul. So historically in North America, I don't think this is news to anybody, we've been socialized toward an aversion to death, right? We know it, we feel it. We push it away. We delay the conversation or avoid it entirely. How to clear a room if I walk in and say to peers or family, would you like to talk about death and dying? Zoop! There they all go. And so thank you for staying. This is one of the first times everybody stayed. But nobody wants to talk about it. It's uncomfortable. It brings up scary things for us. So there's the first part of our job. So we refuse to look at death as a natural progression of life in the physical body. We see it as it's happening. I don't look and feel the way I did when I was 16 or 23 or 55. We see it happening, but we refuse to acknowledge where that's leading. And sometimes we tend to turn the experience over to professionals who, even though they don't know the dying person like we do, they don't know my mom or your brother or your husband. They tell us, we rely on them to tell us what to do, what to think, how to feel, and what to say. It feels good to hand that off, but it's not right. We could do it better. So my favorite hospice cases are with a little bit of guidance and training that families feel competent to perform the care for their loved one. The families that say, we can do this. The families that say, Janet will call you if we need you. I'm doing the happy dance out the door when that happens because it makes me so happy that they've got that feeling that they can do that. So the families partner toward their own unique experience in their own family. And it's a huge success and triumph because how are you going to feel after you've successfully helped a loved one toward their death, a pain-free, peaceful death? For the rest of your life, you're going to hold that in your heart, I pretty much guarantee. So competence equals confidence. Education alleviates anxiety, and preparation surmounts fear. So think about the preparation for other life events. Buying a car, would you not look at the sticker price or not test drive it before you bought it? That would be kind of silly. Buying life insurance, would you sign it without reading that it's what you're going to need when the time comes? Taking a vacation, is anybody just going to drive away without their GPS or a wallet full of money and no plan of where to go? We make preparations for other things. It's almost ridiculous that we don't for this. So think about having a baby. This is a big one, and it's at the exact opposite spectrum as dying is, our birth. Many babies are planned, so even before that child is conceived, there's been a plan to bring that child into the world. We take a class. And we're going to learn how to breathe, and we're going to learn how to relax our muscles so that process goes easier. We're probably going to get a doctor, search around for a doctor that we know and like. We're going to play music that we've already chosen very carefully for when the baby's born. I bet in that little suitcase there's an outfit for the mom and the baby to go home, so we've already planned that. And probably before that baby leaves the hospital, they already have a name. So you can see on that end of the spectrum, of course, it feels like a happier event, but look at all of the preparation that we have for that event. Death is a major life event. Someday we have to look at that and we've got to say, I need to step up. So typical preparations for death might be that somebody would prepave their funeral, and it's usually, I'm going to do this now so I don't have to think about it. It's not part of the process of thinking about it. It's let's get done with it so I don't have to think about it anymore. It's done. Estate planning. So your property and possessions, you want to know who they're going to be dispersed to. That's a pretty common thing. And then the medical part. What do I want and not want if I should become incapacitated for making my own decisions? Those are pretty common to do. But the atypical preparations for death, which are just as important, are the psychological, the emotional, and the spiritual ones. And we don't do it. So what holds us back from that? What holds us back? Here's a quote by Randall Krakauer. He's an author and a medical doctor. And he says, acceptance of one's own mortality is a process, not an epiphany. So it's not going to be a moment that I understand and I'm good with death. It's going to be a process, and probably it's going to have to be a process that I lead myself through. So take time to stand in your own personal space. Confront and discover your intimate feelings about death. What feelings come up when you think about death? What are you confused about? What are you fearful of? This is like an onion, by the way. You don't open it up and say, okay, I'm done with it. You take the skin off, and you look at that layer, and then you take another layer off, and you look at that, and you go deeper and deeper and deeper. And that's really the only way to uncover how you really feel and where your feelings are going to settle as far as something this serious. So you can ask yourself, is death scary, or might it be sacred? Is it sad, or could it be joyous? Is it an end, or could it be a new beginning? Do we have fear of the unknown? Of course we do. Anything we've tried the very first time in our life has been scary. And if it's been something that nobody's been able to guide you with, doesn't come with an owner's manual or guidance, it's twice as scary. So understandably so, death is scary. But fear can render us paralyzed, and it can render us ineffective in helping ourselves and helping others through sickness and dying. So hospice patients, in my mind, are in a space that they are the most vulnerable, they're the most beautiful, and they're most authentic that they've ever been. A hospice secret is that people die the way they live. So if I've been a crusty old curmudgeon my whole life, it's pretty sure that I'm going to go out that way. If I've been a peacemaker in my life, it's pretty sure that I'm going to have a peaceful death and be a peaceful person at that time. The dying have no pretenses. They have no ego. What for? Right? They don't need it anymore. Who do I need to impress? So our goals and wishes and obligations with this are to reach a place of comfort that allows us to enter sacred space with one another. It's a personal journey, just like dying is. So I'm going to read a little passage called Gone From My Sight from the book. And unfortunately, this passage is anonymous. And I say unfortunately because it's so beautiful, and somebody should have gotten credit for it. It's called Gone From My Sight, and it says, I'm standing upon a seashore. A ship at my side spreads her white sails to the morning breeze and starts for the blue ocean. She's an object of beauty and strength. I stand and watch her until at length she hangs like a speck of white cloud just where the sea and the sky come to mingle with each other. Then someone at my side says, there, she's gone. Gone where? I ask. Merely gone from my sight, comes the answer. The ship itself still exists. She is just as large in mast and hull and spar as she was when she left my side. And she is just as able to bear her load of living freight to her destined port. She's diminished in size merely from my perspective, not in herself. And just at the moment when someone at my side says, there, she's gone, other eyes are watching her approach, and voices are ready to take up the glad shout, here she comes, and that's dying. Isn't that beautiful? It's widely used in funerals and memorial services and things like that, but somebody should have got credit for it. So let's talk a little bit. I was just commenting about the parallels about what we see leaving. It's just such a beautiful parallel to know that it's arriving more powerful and beautiful in another place. So how do we change our perceptions? I'm going to talk about a Cherokee legend between a conversation between a grandfather and his grandson, and this also came up in a movie called Tomorrowland, between a father and a daughter. But the grandfather says to the grandson, there are two wolves in life, a big black wolf and a big white wolf, and they're always fighting. They're fighting and fighting and fighting. Which one's going to win? And the grandson listens. He thinks for a while. He says, I don't know, grandfather. Which one's going to win? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. The one you feed. So which one do you feed? In any area of your life, which one do you feed? You can make that choice. In the death and dying, which one are we going to feed? So I would also like to mention that there's few similarities between the death we see on TV and movies and in real life. We see violence, and we see crisis, and we see emergencies, and we see death that doesn't look very pretty most of the time. But in a controlled setting, in controlled circumstances, I like to say that it's like seeing a candle slowly burning down a little more and a little bit more and a little bit more until finally it's just extinguished. And it really can be that beautiful and that quiet. So let's talk about some cultural progress that we have made. In the 1930s, my mom's experience, she was a little girl. She lost her mom at 3. She lost her dad before she was 12. And the societal trends around that time were that people were discouraged from talking about the deceased. It's as if they never existed, even to the children. We don't talk about that. And explains how death got secreted away from what used to be the homestead, where all the births and deaths and everything in between happened at home. But part of our culture changed that, and then it was on a downward slide as far as us being comfortable with death. 1950s and 60s were pretty much the same, but then in the 70s, a major shift regarding funerals happened. Where it used to be 3 days, I remember as a child, 3 days of a funeral home, towels over the mirrors, dressed in black, weeping and sobbing and shushing the children. We changed that, we shifted that to what we now consider a celebration of someone's life. So how much more healthy is that to celebrate who they are and what they accomplished and who they were to you rather than all of this deep mourning and the way that we had done it. I don't know if anybody was familiar, but in the 1990s, there was a trend called death dinners. Did anybody ever hear about that? Okay, see? So families were getting together at the time. They're actually called death dinners, and families were getting together at the time and gathering the whole family like you would for a holiday, the children, the grandparents, aunts and uncles, everybody, and having a big dinner with the focus being talking about death. And so they talked about their thoughts, their fears, their wishes, and getting the conversation out of the shadows. It was really healthy because it gave people an excuse to do it, for one thing. And the second thing is that even the children were hearing their parents talk about their impermanence. Grandma and grandpa finally got to say, I don't think I have much time here left on the earth. So these were really, really good things to have happen. It didn't last long. People thought it was morbid, and the trend died. We could start it again, though. We could start it again. We could do it in our own families. So, journeying forward, our goal is helping ourselves help others with dying and to be fully present in the experience. I think some of us know what centered and grounded means, but even if we know it, wringing my hands and being at the door with a, you know, the deer in the headlights look and worrying about it isn't being fully present. And the way that I can eliminate not being able to be fully present is to do some of the work that allows me to be fully present. And we know what some of those are, and we'll talk about some more. So doing our best in this situation of helping someone die or assisting ourselves in our own death, doing our best is going to be receiving our best. And it allows us to be a part of the process instead of a part of the process. We'll journey with another, and what a gift for both parties. Every explorer that's ever lived, that ever discovered anything, had to venture from one place of comfort to uncharted territory for new discoveries and adventures, or those discoveries never would have been made. It's not really so different than this. We're the explorers. So I want to tell you a little bit about Michael and Mary's journey. This was a very recent patient that I had. And even after all these years in a hospice, it was a very unique closeness that this couple had. And I was their nurse. So I got to witness this with my eyes and with my heart every single day for a long time. So it's a story of incredible willingness for them to enter this uncharted territory for the sake of another. Michael was only 57 years old, young, right? He'd been married to Mary for 30 years, and they still had 3 of their 7 children living at home. So after Michael received his terminal diagnosis, Mary halted every aspect of her life to spend that precious time and valuable time with him and to be totally engaged on every level and devoted to him on his journey. Together, Mary and Michael joined hands, they joined their heart, they joined their spirit, and they walked through his dying together. Mary was able to get on Michael's level and meet him where he was at and to ask him the hard questions. What is this like for you? What do you need for this to be easier? How can I help you get ready? And what are your fears? Michael became homebound pretty quickly with his illness, and Mary brought him catalogs from the funeral home. In the privacy of his own house, she allowed him to choose his casket, and when he had done so, she asked him to help choose hers. There wasn't any need. Mary wasn't sick, and she's a fairly young woman. But this is what she decided to do. If I'm going to be in this, I'm going to be in this. She wasn't just talking the talk. She was walking the walk. Mary chose to take every step of the journey with him. She visited burial sites, pulled out her cell phone, took pictures, and purchased cemetery lots together with him. This is where we are going to be, not this is where you're going to be. It was rare and beautiful to see this closeness and how they walked through this together. Total connectedness. Michael had company on the whole journey. No isolation, no separation from his family or others. And he had a happy and peaceful death. So this example shows us that it can be done. We can be an integral part of the dying process for someone else if we want to do the little bit of work that comes along with it. So where does faith fit into this? Most faiths believe in some type of a beautiful afterlife. I'm coming from a Christian perspective, and so I'll talk a little bit about that. That Jesus not only talked about it, but he promised it. There are multitudes of references in the Bible and in Scripture about eternal life. John 14, verse 2 says, "My Father's house has many rooms. If it were not true, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you?" Matthew 5, verse 12 says, "Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven." Other belief systems might view heaven as a place, a state of mind, or universal connection to divine love, whatever that is. And God may be viewed as source, spirit, great spirit, energy. It can be helpful to have some faith beliefs regarding death. Some families and some patients rely on it heavily, and some not at all. I have run into a number of atheists and agnostics in hospice between the patients and the families, and I've talked to them about their belief or non-belief. And they've described their non-belief as there's nothing after life. There's just nothing. There's total darkness. There's a void. There's an abyss. Have you ever heard there's no atheists in a foxhole? So, not all, but many who have no belief system, when they reach their time and place of leaving, many demonstrate some fear, maybe a feeling of wanting to backpedal a little bit and have a do-over, or at least reconsideration of beliefs. It's just an observation. There's no judgment with that. It's just an observation that I made. Belief in some type of afterlife should give us confidence in the process of dying because it means that things aren't really over. If we allow it into our consciousness, it can give us many things, the confidence and peace and hope. Comfort and security are most assuredly found in the belief of heaven and afterlife or something grand beyond this life on earth. So what's your view of the afterlife? These are just some images we put up. They might express your view, they might not, but they're some of the things that we associate with heaven or the afterlife. I would say that's probably a Christian perspective. This might be love and light. Again, that stairway to heaven leading to someplace beautiful. Maybe, what would we call that one? Who has an idea? What's that?
Don't point the
New age, go toward the light, energy, maybe, energy, okay. Cosmos. And maybe something that we haven't considered before, okay? Maybe it looks something entirely different than what we might think or what we know. But those are just some images. So we're going to move on to what some patients have told me during their dying. Comments from those close to death. Louis woke up one day after being in a coma for almost a week, and he smiled and said, "Shh, that's God talking. Do you hear it?" I didn't hear it. Andy looked around the room just moments before he died, and he said, "My gosh, there are 8, 12, 19 angels in here right now." A very dear patient of mine who recently passed told me every single night before her death that her mother showed up holding a book of light out to her. This is very comforting things when you're getting ready to leave. This one, we had a new patient coming on hospice, and he had been just talking to me and drinking a can of lemonade a minute before, but then he said, "You'll have to leave, they've come for me." And we said, "Who's come for you?" And I knew his wife was deceased, but he made a motion like this to his side. He said, "This is my wife," and he bowed his head and he said, "And this is our Lord." So we did what he asked. We left the room, and he was gone within 5 minutes. And he knew, and that was either his vision or his visitation, but that's what he told us about his dying. Here's some kind of funny ones. I had a patient who was actively dying. She hadn't spoken much, but she woke up one day and was addressing all of these people, one by one, that we couldn't see. And I sat on the bed with her, and I held her hand, and she continued to talk to the people behind me that she saw. And she said, "Oh, look, there goes a gaunter." And I said, "A what, Anna?" And she said, "A gaunter, you know." Gaunter is my grandfather's surname. And I had never discussed that with her. I don't know how she knew it, but she very clearly told me twice that there was a gaunter standing behind me. So another lady who had severe dementia, she couldn't have even told you her name. As she was dying and I was sitting with her, she grabbed my hand and she said, "Remember, you need to finish your book." We had never talked about a book. She wouldn't have remembered if I had. But very clearly, she was tuning into whatever you want to call universal consciousness or tapping into something about my energy that was giving her these messages. So remember that they're experiencing something new, a higher level of understanding and vision and communication. And it's very interesting. And I guess the main point of showing some of these is because that's what can be in store for you if you work with the dying, if you take the time to be comfortable enough with it that you're open, okay? So I'm going to read something else called A Penny from Heaven. Really short, but it also tells about these little bits of wonderful, wonderful magic that happens sometimes. This actually happened several weeks after a young man died, and his mother called to report this to me. But she had been connected to him prior to his death, during his death, and still felt that strong connection after. So, the death of any person, no matter the age or circumstances, is difficult for those left behind. No matter how much preparation one has to face the event, it's never enough for the actual loss when it occurs. If the relationship had been close, then missing the person is what's hardest. If the relationship had been strained, it's the loss of the opportunity for it to have been something else, something better. There might even appear a sense of guilt or remorse, a wishing that things had been different, that one had done more, or one had loved more. I think the most difficult grief, however, is that of a parent when losing a child. No one expects to outlive their children, especially before the children reach adulthood. It becomes not just the loss of the special person the parents brought into the world, but the loss of so many hopes and dreams. Brian was only 18 years old when he died. He and his mother had shared a special bond. Understanding and remembering that closeness made it easier for her to bear her grief most of the time. She was a spiritual person and usually felt strengthened by the time that she spent praying after Brian died, but one day her strength was gone. She missed her son and began to feel anger. She turned her anger into a prayer of sorts and cried, "Why, Brian? How could you do that? I don't understand." She said she wept for a long time in a way that she hadn't allowed herself to do since her son had passed away. Having spent her anger and energy but feeling lonely and empty, She went to the local supermarket. She remembers every detail of what happened next. She says that she was standing in the pudding section of the store and looked up to see a middle-aged man about 6 feet away who was staring at her intently. He had a hat on, a slight beard, and the bluest eyes she had ever seen, except for those of her son, Brian. I can attest to that blue, since I had visited Brian during his illness. He had eyes the color of clear Caribbean waters, exactly like those of the man she was meeting now. Brian's mother felt uncomfortable momentarily and looked away. When she looked up seconds later, the man was standing very close to her, holding his hat. A single tear rolled out of one of his crystal blue eyes and down his cheek, and he said, "You look as if you're missing a part of yourself." She immediately thought of the answer she always gave when well-meaning friends would ask, "How are you coping after Brian's death?" "I feel as if I'm missing part of myself." The man held out a coin and placed it in the palm of her hand. She looked down and turned it over to see that it was inscribed, "In Jesus, all things are possible." She began to cry silently and looked up. The man who had given her the coin was no longer beside her, nor was he anywhere in sight. Brian's mother has the coin to this day, and she knows that her son, or another messenger, was sent to her with this special healing gift just when her despair was the greatest. So, some of the behaviors of those close to death, and these are frequent. This isn't a once-per-chance thing. These are frequent or pretty universal. Smiling at something unseen, looks of ecstasy and awe, witnessing unexplainable joy during dying, plucking at clothes and blankets. They pluck out in the air as if they're trying to reach something, and they pluck at their clothes as if they're trying to get out of their earthly body. That's what it looks like to me. One man was plucking out here and smiling, and I asked him, "Jim, what are you reaching for?" And he said, "Jesus is tossing me gold coins, and I'm catching them." And he was delighted to be playing catch with Jesus. But also the words, "I need to go home," even though they are home, even though they know they're home, they know that they're getting ready to leave. Those are some of the things that we see and hear. I feel we have ascending here, but I feel a descending of something sacred in the dying space. I feel a divine presence that's comforting, enfolding, and loving. Sometimes we'll see a wisp like smoke or steam come up from the body as the spirit leaves or gather in the mouth. Sometimes we'll see a glow of a little bit of violet color, usually around the person in transition, as if their inner light is already visible. The evidence isn't always seen, but it's felt in the heart as a fullness or knowing. Remember that only a glimpse of what the dying experienced can be seen by us, because it's not our time. I had a gentleman who only spoke Spanish, who was the patient, and his daughter was doing the translations. And when I arrived, she said, "I don't know, he's been looking at that wall and talking to his brother all day long, and his brother has been gone for 5 years. And she said, if he's talking to his brother, how come I can't see him? I said, "Ask your dad." So she asked him in Spanish, "How come I can't see Uncle John?" And her dad looked toward the wall and addressed the question there, and then answered back to her. And she said, "He says because it's not my time, it's his time." So as we accompany others, we get a peek behind that sacred veil that's humbling, transforming, and can leave you speechless at times. What's the prerequisite for the training to be able to do this with people that we know or love? Or in a clinical situation, if you choose to be a hospice volunteer or something, simply a willingness and fullness of the heart and choosing again to be fully present in the dying space. So the way to do this is to be in a place of understanding, a place of compassion, and allowing without fear. Fear's a big one, isn't it? It can block our ability to be able to experience these things fully. Educate yourself. There is so much written literature, books on the internet, in the library about death and dying. Start to read it. Start to think about it. Start to ask your own self questions about it. And then you're more ready to explore your own beliefs and feelings about death and dying. Be willing to change what you already feel into a more positive direction. Let go of those things that we've been taught in our society. Dying has taught me to live well. That's the name of my book. Live better. Hospice has been my teacher. I've seen death close up for 18 years. I know it comes for others, and it's going to come for me. and it's making it a lot easier to have had this exposure and to have the opportunity to do the process that the doctor talked about. Oh, look who's here. Everybody remembers Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson in The Bucket List, and this was a hilarious comedy. It was a great movie, some tearful parts about it, but it's an invaluable concept. We joke about it, but actually do it. Begin to condition yourself to the idea of your own impermanence on the earth. The limited amount of time you have for all you want to accomplish here and all you are meant to accomplish here, all you are destined to accomplish here. Start thinking about that impermanence. None of us are going to live forever. Let your list encourage you toward living happily now. Not when I retire, not when I get a new job, not when I lose 30 pounds. Start to do it now. Live happily. We don't know when that time's going to come. Matthew 25, verse 13 says, therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour. Matthew 24, verse 36 says, but about that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. We don't know. Start now. I should have made that one flashing. Oh, I have a beautiful little video here for you. I don't know if you're, are you going to be able to see it, Linda? Can I pull this back? You can see it? Okay. It's called A Vida de Morte, which actually means the life of death. So what I'd like you to do is as you watch this, it's only 5 minutes long, and it's animated. No words. It's just viewing. Start watching for what you can pick out as symbolism of a more positive view to death. Okay?
Thank you.
So you saw the credits for that. That's by Marcia Ondersteigen. It is not my video. I would urge you to watch it many more times, because it feels like every time I have watched it, I've seen more and more symbolism in there. So just to share a few, did you notice what a scary mask we put on Death, who really is kind of just like a chubby little flying guy, right? You know, he's not so scary, but we put this scary mask on him. The bird and the fox, if you notice, were already down. That bird was laying on the grass. Death wasn't going around and just randomly killing things. There was a reason for it. The interaction with the deer. Did you see the deer's reluctance at the beginning? Not yet, I'm not ready. But also knowing what death was. It didn't run away in fear, it pranced away. Death followed life at a distance. It's always there, but it's not interfering, right? Mutual respect. When death touched the flowers and they died, ooh, what did I do? Kind of thing. And then the deer became either feeble or old or ill in some way. And it approached death. It leaned into death, and death embraced it. So there's a lot more in there. That's just a little bit about what we can talk about, but it really is a beautiful little film, isn't it? Yeah, I like it too. A little weird, but kind of nice too. So how dying has changed me. My patients have changed my mind toward filling my thoughts and my days with things that matter, filling my consciousness, my heart, and my time with things that I love. No more wasting time. My patients have taught me to love maybe things I never considered loving before. Try something new. I'm going to try Brussels sprouts. I really am. It's going to be difficult, but maybe by the time I go, I'll like Brussels sprouts. Challenging things and adversity. What is challenge really but an opportunity? Here's case in point. This is not a fashion statement. I didn't plan to wear this here tonight, but when this happened last week, my impulse, of course, was to get really mad, and this is going to ruin my outfit for the show, and it's going to make me walk funny, and I'm going to miss work, and all these bad things are going to happen, and I just did my best to turn it around and say, how nice is it going to be just to be and not to do for a while? Just to have that quiet time that none of us really find or carve out space for, you know? So, challenge, opportunity, you decide. So, wonderful things. My family, my friends, and my coworkers, they've taught me to love life. They've taught me to let go of things that hold me back, and God knows there are plenty of them, aren't there? To endeavor toward my emotional and spiritual needs, because my physical needs will follow. They've taught me to develop and nurture my spirit, which is a daily renewal. We all know it's two steps forward, one step back half the time, but making the effort every day really counts. I pray more. I contemplate more. I release my emotions. I enhance my spirit. And it's good to start small, because we can't tackle all these things all at one time, one challenge at a time, one day at a time, one moment at a time if needed. So here are those wolves again, and they're kind of facing off here. There's the evil one, the black one over here that's evil and stands for all the things that we really don't want, and the white one. And right there, they're probably wondering too, which one of us is going to live? Which one of us is going to live? So the realization and understanding is that there is no time or room for anger, envy, greed, guilt, jealousy, inferiority, ego, all those things that so heavily hold us back. Because the black wolf, it drains my time and energy. Black wolf doesn't enhance my mind, my body, or my spirit. None of them. Black wolf depletes my soul that I hope will one day return home. I'm enriched when I fill my time with all of these beautiful things, mostly heart energy, right? Heart chakra, joy, light, peace, hope, love, kindness, humility, trust, forgiveness. I have one more, gratitude, which is so important. Put that one maybe at the top. White wolf fulfills my time and energy. White wolf enhances all three, my mind, my body, and my spirit. My white wolf enlarges my soul that I want to return home someday. So which wolf will you choose to feed? We can change our culture toward death, one person, one life, one death at a time. You have to be brave enough, courageous enough to educate yourself to be fully present when given the beautiful opportunity to be with the dying. Don't run from it. Don't shirk from it. Be courageous. Doing so is a gift to yourself and to another as you journey holistically together. The rewards are worth it for others and for you in your own time. So all of these things that we've talked about today, promoting a peaceful passage, accepting and acknowledging the dying condition, confronting and discovering your own intimate feelings about these things, all are so important. Be willing to change in a positive direction, but furthermore, be willing to speak about death. Say the word. If you have to whisper it, fine. If you have to say it in the mirror a few times, fine. But be willing to talk about it and say it out loud and really discover what it means within you and with those that you love. Get on that bucket list. I'm not kidding you. Out of all these, that's probably the most fun one, definitely. I'm going hang gliding, whatever. But the most fun one, but also the one that keeps reminding you, I've only got so much time to do these things, and I don't know how much time it's going to be, right? Live well. Grow your relationship with your faith beliefs. Face your black wolf, but feed your white wolf. So, sort of in closing, what I'd like to say that the dying teach us how to spend valuable time connecting our earthly self with our spiritual self so that these two separate but very vital aspects of our being aren't strangers when they meet as the time of our own death draws near. My prayer for you is a poem by Bob Perks. And it says, I wish you enough sun to keep your attitude bright. I wish you enough rain to appreciate the sun more. I wish you enough happiness to keep your spirit alive. I wish you enough pain so that the smallest joys in life appear much brighter. I wish you enough gain to satisfy wanting. I wish you enough loss to appreciate all you possess. I wish you enough hellos to get you through the final goodbye. Thank you.
How does a person know when it is time to enter hospice?
When it is time to enter hospice?
Yes.
Okay. Medicare has very specific guidelines about who can be on hospice and when they can come on. One thing is for certain is that you must have a terminal disease. It may be that long one that I talked about, or it may be something where your medical professionals know that it's going to be a short journey. But it has to be a terminal diagnosis, and you have to be done with curative treatment. Because Medicare, as we know, has their curative treatment and they have hospice, but they don't cross over. So it would be after you've been given a terminal diagnosis and when you have decided not to have any further curative treatment. Does that answer your question?
I just have a comment to your just what you said, because Medicare can even get more specific than that.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law died of kidney failure. And it was not only the fact that she had never accepted curative care because mm-hmm. she refused dialysis, mm-hmm. but that her blood work, her creatinine to be a specific, mm-hmm. had to be a certain number before mm-hmm. they would let her go on hospice. Mm-hmm. So it can get really tricky. She needed hospice before that, but she didn't get it because mm-hmm. they won't allow it.
Mm-hmm. That's true. There's a whole nother conversation with that. I was giving the most simple answer for people that were interested in what are my basic guidelines for that.
This has been a very enlightening lecture. And what this year, a friend of mine and I, we decided to live this year as if it was our last. So we are, every day we are learning something very profound about ourselves and what are our priorities. So it's been an adventure so far. So I have 9 more months to go. So
I just have a question. What urged you to do such a thing?
Pardon me?
What urged you to make that decision?
Well, I come from an Indian culture, and death has been part of us all the time.
Yes.
I mean, even as kids, we saw processions, bodies moving along, and we used to follow them all the way to the funeral pyre. Sure. And watch it. And so I've always been wanting to do a practice like that. So this was just an opportunity that two of us, also this friend of mine has been a hospice nurse for 30 years.
Okay, now I know why you did it. That's a good reason. I'm glad you're connected with her.
So there's the connection.
Yes, thank you.
spirituality for you is Christian based, and I wanted to know how you feel your spirituality changed when you look at yourself spiritually from before you started as a hospice nurse and now.
Oh, I would say that I was probably a sunflower seed before, and now I'm the sunflower. It just exploded my spirituality within myself and with what I feel is my connection.
Yeah. And then a second question related to that. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about, I call it life after life because of Moody. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about life after life?
There's a story in the book about my involvement in a death with a patient where I accompanied them a certain way. But I do believe it. I hear it all the time. Many of my patients who are in the dying process had died in the past in this life. And they just skated right through because they knew exactly where they were going and what they were doing. And they talked about it and the magnificence and no fear. So I've seen that many times with my patients, yes.
Mm-hmm. Will hospice eventually get involved in assisted death situations? More specifically, do you see hospice making sure that the caregiver has enough of the drugs needed for assisted death?
That is not a line that we cross, especially because it's legal. In my personal belief system, that crosses a lot of lines. I don't believe that our government, like Medicare, is ever going to pay for assisted suicide. I think we're a long way from that, if ever. And no, I think that if more people understood and could see how beautiful a death can be under controlled circumstances with the right elements in place, meaning the people and the help that they can have with that process and our understanding and our being present, that I'm not even sure that there's a need.
Talking about healthcare, I think most of us here are baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And by the time that we get older, like the system won't be able to afford, you know, to take care of all of us. So I think physician-assisted suicide will become an option during that day. Now, like your personal belief says that you think that this cheapens the death process.
No, but, I didn't say cheapen.
Okay, you know, but I said, but I think it's tainted. Because sometimes, like I said, to choose to take your own life when you have a terminal illness costs less than, like if we're talking totally, you know, like just from a perspective of financial, will cost much more than a person choosing. See, but I think that's your personal opinion on that, mm-hmm. and I can respect that, but I have to disagree mm-hmm. with that.
I didn't mean to imply that it was tainted in any way. It's certainly a different end of the spectrum than a controlled, natural, expected death. That's all I was saying about it.
Do you work at a hospice in the Chicago area? Mm-hmm. Which
it's
one is
Harbor
it?
Harbor Light Hospice. That's right here in Glen Ellyn. It's also, we're in 11 different states, I believe, right now.
Are there volunteer positions there?
Yes, there are. And what a great way to get initiated to the death and dying process by maybe companioning with somebody for weeks or months while they're a little bit more healthy, and then being part of that dying process before it's somebody that's near and dear to your heart. Not that they don't become that way, because they do. Every patient becomes that way, and every volunteer companion does as well. But it is a way to be able to do that. So yes, we do have volunteer department, very active volunteer department.
I just want to ask you a question. I don't know, we don't have the experience. Nobody has the experience of death. So you think there is a threshold pain experience before death? If that is what I was thinking is, you know, depending on what attitude I have towards fear of death or attachment to life, that might create some pain, and which I might, if I cross the threshold, I might resist the pain and go into unconscious and not experience the death. Or, you know, is it possible that threshold is so low that we might not go unconscious and not experience the death?
Well, we know that emotional pain and spiritual pain cause physical pain. And that's why being able to alleviate unencumber somebody that way is so important. It's an important part of the process. I'm not saying that nobody needs pain medication at the end of life. There is even the circumstance where somebody needs to be terminally sedated, which means that they have such great pain with their disease process, which may be compounded by emotional pain, that they have to have enough medication that they don't have to concentrate on their body. Because the evidence that I've seen, that we know, is that when you're concentrating on your body and the pain that's there or the feelings that are there, you tend to linger in the dying process longer than you have to. And so if you can get those things under control, away you go.
I'm trying to understand exactly what hospice is. Is it a group of people that go from place to place, or is it a location?
Both. Actually. There are some hospice, freestanding hospice buildings, one in Joliet, one in Bolingbrook, one in Barrington Hills, where people can go at the very end of life, and they try to gauge this, which is hard to do sometimes, for being the last weeks, maybe the last month and a half. But there's a hospice team that will go to nursing homes, assisted living places, and private homes as that team to do the care in whatever environment that patient is in. So it's really both.
I just wanted to make a comment about the physician-assisted dying. You know, in Oregon, where it's been legal for many years now, there's been many people that have passed all the criteria to get the medication to kill themselves, because they have to take the pills themselves. Mm-hmm. But only, my understanding is, only about 2 or 3% of those people who've been given the medication actually end up using it. It's the fact that they've got the choice, and the choice is sitting right there in a bottle in their house, that they can do this. But most of them, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if 97% of them don't choose it, mm-hmm. that's pretty good.
That's true, and that's sort of the benefit and the burden, like you talk about with medications, is it's sitting there in case I need it, but what if today I'm just having a bad day, and tomorrow I'd really like to still be here? You know what I'm saying? It's available and it's there. Those are all the tricky questions that kind of fog up the conversation about that, yeah. Right? Yeah.
All right, Janet, I just have a couple comments. One, when I started doing hospice work in the 70s, mm-hmm. The average stay for the patient was 6 months. When I went back to do an in-service in the 90s, it was down to 2 weeks. So I just wondered what it is now, the average stay.
This is another Medicare thing, is that Medicare, the referring physician for this patient, has to be able to say that in his best judgment, this patient will not be here in 6 months. That doesn't mean somebody gets kicked out at the 6 month mark. What we have to do, they have to be able to say that it's a likelihood that that patient won't be here anymore after 6 months. If they are still here, it's up to those of us who are documenting and visiting that patient to be able to tell Medicare why we're still there. We're managing pain, we're managing the family. You know, we have wounds now. Patient's been bedridden for a while. You know, any sign of decline that we can show that they are still in that disease process doesn't matter so much with the cancers and things like that, because those are pretty much self-limited. But things like Parkinson's and things like Alzheimer's that can have a very long trajectory sometimes are a little bit difficult. And sometimes people do graduate from hospice. It's been a year, things haven't changed, they've leveled out a little bit, and they come off hospice until such time that they start their decline again. And then they can be readmitted to hospice again.
I know I'm supposed to be just delivering the microphone, but it's a very interesting comment, because from a personal experience regarding my brother who passed away a couple of years ago in Australia, in Melbourne, and there it's much shorter. The physician who is referring the patient to hospice, mm-hmm. it's much shorter than mm-hmm. 6 months. It's mm-hmm. Between 2 weeks and a month, I think, is the
That's prognosis. It's pretty hard to gauge, so they must have crystal balls there.
Well, they don't, but if they feel that it's not like, for instance, my brother had pancreatic cancer, and he was given like 3 months, and they wouldn't move him into hospice
The
last few months, the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, one way I'll address that, John, is that 18 years ago when I went into hospice, Jim, you might know this as well, is that people came on hospice pretty much as they were dying. It was much closer. If you had them for 3 months, that was a long-term patient. And over time, because Medicare has broadened its parameters a little bit, it's frequent that they're on 6 months, 12 months, could be longer than that. So you're right about that. There were much more deaths in quick succession when I first started with hospice than there are now for that reason.
Hi, Mom. Do patients share with you specific regrets about their life toward the end? And if so, what are the most common ones? Or what are patients worrying about when they are talking about leaving their lives?
They seem to be more other-directed than themselves. It's not so much about themselves. It's how are my children going to do without me? It's will my grandchildren remember me? Is my husband going to know how to run the dishwasher? You know, it's more other-directed, worrying about the people around you. But sometimes the regrets are, I was never truly myself. You know, I let everybody else tell me what to do. Or there were things I wanted to try, and I never gave myself permission to do that. So those different kind of things that are heavy on their soul. But a lot of them are directed outwards. Their tasks at the end, they want to be writing letters to their children and to their grandchildren and making contact, if even by phone, to people they haven't seen that meant a lot to them, or that maybe they butted heads with somewhere along the way and never cleared that up. It's important. They want that unfinished business to be taken care of. Yeah.
There's one more question through the internet.
Oh, no.
When my brother was dying in hospice, he kept putting his hands on the top of his head and trying to tell me something. I thought that he was trying to tell me he wanted to leave. Have you ever seen anyone else do that before? Do you have any idea as to what he was trying to do?
You know, we see a lot of behaviors and we talked a lot about them, and we can really only guess at what that looks like. That sounds to me, again, like I want to get out of my body. Maybe they thought there was a zipper there, that he could just leave if I can just get out of this body. But it doesn't reflect pain. It doesn't really reflect what we think of as anxiety. It's more, I have something to do and I can't get it to work. I can't leave. And so there are people that we're constantly dressing because they literally take their clothes off every 5 minutes, again, in an effort, I think, to try and get out of this earthling suit and whoosh, and go. So it may have been related to that.
What are your thoughts about what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has written about death and dying?
Everything. She started the movement. My friend Jim here and I talked about this because he had the honor, you can speak more to that, of working with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And yes, she was the force behind the movement, wasn't she? With hospice and death and dying and it being taught the way it needs to be taught. Would you like to address any of that, Jim?
Well, the other thing is her experience
with hospice. Wait.
Elizabeth's experiences, I worked with her off and on for about 30 years before she passed in the 90s. But she grew up in Europe, and she was in one of the concentration camps. And her experiences were watching people die all around her, and especially children. And what she said later was, you know, when she wrote the book on death and dying, was based mainly on people who were close to dying and close to death. She later, as she worked at the University of Chicago, got more familiar with the process itself and the survivors. And that's where she shifted, you know, her emphasis later on. And there's a guy named Grohlman, you know, Earl Grohlman?
No.
He was one of her students, and he was a Jewish rabbi out east, and he kind of took up her work from there on, and I think he's still writing, but he was a professor at one of the mm-hmm. universities there in Boston. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they moved it forward, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and there's a new person right around here who has even carried it on further mm-hmm. with the whole idea of death and dying and the mm-hmm. the process and, you know, grief mm-hmm. and grieving.
Sort of like we made momentum there and then things kind of backslid is what it feels like sometimes, doesn't it? And so maybe we can get it moving again.
One more question through the internet. Do physicians stop curative care because of Medicare rules? My mum's doctor is stopping Pradaxa and she just started hospice.
No, they don't. That, I'm not familiar with that medication. There are new ones that come out every month. If that is something that's meant to treat a cancer or actively treat a disease, they don't stop medications just so that somebody can come on hospice. They may stop because, like some of our patients we talked about, they've tried all the interventions, they've had the tests, they've had the treatments, and it's time to stop because nothing is working. And in fact, some of us know that those medications treated too long can actually cause your death. So that's why a lot of them are stopped.
I'm a mailman, and I have like an older lady on my route, and she was dying. And she came right out and asked me, like, what did I think that would happen to her, you know, like after she died. And I'm not the most spiritual person that you want to talk to about this. You know? That's why I have a problem with that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So I told her, I said to her, whatever your concept is of love, that's what you'll see when you pass on. I said, if it's your mother, that's who you'll see first. If you believe in Jesus, that's who you see first. I said, you never hear a Muslim saying, I saw Jesus after I died, or a Jewish person. So these things are conceptual. Mm-hmm. You know, like you can have your own personal faith, like what you think. But I always tell them that whenever someone is dying, the people who you leave behind want to think that you're going to go to the place that they see as them going to. You know, so I always say, give them what they want. If they're a Christian, say, Jesus, come find me. You know, like do it. I said, give them the peace. But I said, but it's a conceptual understanding. As each individual person in here understands something different as far as the afterlife goes, you know. So I don't really feed into so much of the religious aspect mm-hmm. of all this, and I never will, you know.
I'm still stuck on your first sentence where you said that she asked her mailman.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I don't mean I'm stuck on it, but here's what I'd say about that. It's often the dying people that are willing to talk about it. Sometimes I've walked in the door or knocked at a door, and the family meets me there and says, take off your name tag, because it's got hospice nurse on it. Take off your name tag, don't say cancer, and don't say dying to mother. And you're like, well, the reason I'm here is because it's cancer, and she's, you know. So I walk in, and the family says, go ahead and have your visit. I walk in, and somebody will stick their hand out and say, hi, I'm Julie. Do you know I'm dying of cancer? Well, there you have it. So that's what we're talking about, trying to bring these conversations together, get the word on the table, get everybody to understand it and talk about it, and then the journey is easy. So it is the dying that talk about it.